You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Cade Young.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB Local News for Monday, August 10th, 2020.
Later in the program, you will hear from Jeff Baldwin, Executive Director of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Bloomington. Baldwin discusses low-cost childcare options available for families in Monroe County.
Also coming up in the next half hour, A Few Minutes with the Mayor, a weekly segment where local residents post questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about community issues. But first, your local headlines.
Here are three local headlines you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Friday, August 10th. I'm Aaron Comforti. 673 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Sunday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. Indiana recorded a four-day streak of at least 1,000 new cases per day leading up to Sunday. According to the CDC, reduced weekend reporting and testing can lead to an apparent sudden drop in coronavirus statistics. Three new deaths were also reported over the weekend. Locally, Monroe County saw 13 new confirmed cases, Lawrence County saw 8, and Brown County saw 1. Two protests took place over the weekend, one in Bloomington, the other in Martinsville. In Bloomington, the so-called Defend the Police protest included groups of people driving pickup trucks and motorcycles mostly around downtown, displaying American flags and pro-police and Trump flags. A picture taken by the Bloomingtonian showed one truck with a Confederate emblem. The caravans of trucks and motorcycles blared their horns and revved engines for a few hours. Some demonstrators were seen carrying assault rifles. Pro-police demonstrations like this one have taken place in a number of cities across the U.S. in recent weeks. The name Defend the Police is a response to calls to defund the police. The calls entered the mainstream conversation in the aftermath of high-profile police killings of Black people, including George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. In Martinsville, protesters held a Black Lives Matter demonstration at the courthouse downtown. They were confronted by counter-protesters from the 3%er group. The group's website portrays it as a defense force of patriotic citizens based on the idea of American Revolutionary War citizen militias like the Minutemen. Its critics call the group a paramilitary organization. According to various news accounts of the event, heated arguments broke out between the two groups, causing the Martinsville police to intervene. They did not make any arrests. Some people in both groups carried assault rifles. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
Monroe County Commissioner Julie Thomas spoke about resident assistance during the August 8th COVID-19 press conference. She said any resident facing potential eviction or other struggles should contact their township trustee.
With the end of the moratorium on evictions and utility disconnections, residents are encouraged to reach out to their township trustee if they are struggling to provide shelter, food, and utilities for their family. Every resident has a township trustee. They are a great fountain of information and resources for you. The commissioners and the council work together to provide additional funding for those township trustees to meet what we anticipate to be exceptional expenses this year. We've already appropriated $100,000 toward this endeavor, and we are poised to allocate additional funding if needed.
Emergency Management Director Allison Moore said township trustees also have face coverings available to residents, along with the fire departments, the emergency management office, and the health office. She said a schedule for pickup can be made by phone call to any of those offices. She said the phone numbers are online at co.monroe.in.us. Moore said monthly blood drives are to be expected.
We also are excited to announce that we have a blood drive scheduled for August 24th. There are still spots currently available at the redcross.org website, where you can go and make an appointment for the blood drive that is going to be at the Monroe County Convention Center. We're also excited to share with you that we plan to have a blood drive every month, sponsored by the Board of Commissioners, for the rest of the 2020 calendar year. We do not have those dates quite yet. We're very close to having those dates secured and having a day every month for the rest of this calendar year. And hopefully by next Friday's press call, I will be able to release those dates for you so that you can find which date would be best for your schedule and hopefully be willing to make a donation to support those in our community that do in fact need blood.
Monroe County Public Health Information Officer Kathy Hewitt said Monroe County's daily positivity average was 3.2%. She said this was a decrease from a surge of cases on July 11th. She said since July 22nd, a similar decrease in positive cases could be seen. She said over a third of the positive cases are from young adults.
The age demographic, 20 to 29-year-olds, continues to have the highest level of both positive test results and the number of tests completed. Right now, they are making up 36.4% of all the positive tests within the county.
President of Indiana University Health, Brian Shockney, said IU Health takes COVID-19 tests to Indianapolis over 6 times per day, which increases result turnaround. He said the average daily COVID patient census dropped from 15 to 11 patients. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton said wastewater system tests could detect COVID prevalence.
The wastewater system does reflect an incidence and prevalence of COVID infection in the solids that are available in the wastewater system. Let's just say that. There are ways to freeze that and test it over time and to look for aggregate levels. So it's experimental, but there's been some evidence. The city of Carmel is doing this. There's some evidence around the country that if you have a surge of infections in a particular place, like you could imagine one large dormitory or one large residential building or a high school or a factory, if you had a surge of infections in those people there, there's data that suggests you can identify that in the waste stream.
Hamilton said more information about a program to test wastewater would be available at a later time.
Hoosier Action, a statewide activist group, held a Zoom conference on Thursday, where the group shared stories of those who are navigating unemployment due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Kate Hess-Pace, director for Hoosier Action, talked about how this pandemic has affected unemployment for thousands of Indiana residents.
Since COVID-19, we know that between 12,000 and 20,000 Hoosiers have applied for unemployment insurance every week, and that the funds, when they receive them, have been life-saving funds for families, making sure that they can continue to feed their families and keep the lights on.
Michelle Evermore, an attorney for the National Employment Law Center, talked about federal talks to provide relief for those who are unemployed.
What we do know is that the House passed legislation to extend the $600 federal pandemic unemployment compensation all the way through to January 31. Hopefully we'll get something close to that. And I think that I'm quite optimistic. I'm hearing more and more from the Hill that, you know, people are starting to understand the effect of the $600. And what that effect is that the entire economy didn't crash. You know, when the numbers came out for unemployment in June, everybody was shocked that it wasn't 20%. And that's because the $600 did what it was supposed to do. It kept people afloat. It kept them able to pay their bills and, remain participating in the economy. And so there, you know, what happens with unemployment insurance is every dollar that's spent generates $1.61 in local economic activity. So having a sufficient benefit has kept people from going homeless. It's kept people from making the decision between whether to buy medicine or pay rent.
Joe Bradley, an Indiana resident who was furloughed, shared his experience with unemployment over the last few months.
My name is Joe. I'm a healthcare chaplain, and I love doing what I do. I've been doing it for a long time. When the pandemic hit, I was chosen among several employees to be furloughed, and that was in April. And I was supposed to go back to work, I guess, first time was with July, and then that got extended until August. Well, a week from Monday, I'm supposed to go back unless it gets extended again. My experience with unemployment has actually been quite positive. I didn't have any trouble getting the checks. They came on a timely basis, and they really helped us to be able to pay our bills. And, you know, the mortgage continues. All the payments continue. We have two adult special needs kids that live with us, and they have needs. And you know, life goes on. We have issues with the car, and we've got to go get it fixed. And we can't just, you know, we have recently taken on a little debt, which we hate to do. But also, I'm very fortunate that I took a part-time job right before this happened to supplement. I had a part-time chaplain position that I lost because of the COVID-19. As you know, senior communities are devastated, and they weren't allowing any visitors, so I couldn't do that anymore. So I'm working part-time, and I have been working part-time in the evenings, and that really helps. And I want everybody, especially the lawmakers, the powers that be, to know this is not an excuse to not work. I am working. I'm working, and I want to go back to work, and I'm looking forward to full time. But this is not being lazy and staying at home. I really want to work. So, but the unemployment has really helped, and it's been really hard this week when that check didn't come, and I don't know what we're going to do if it doesn't come back.
Another resident, Kara, said her experience has not been positive. She shared her story with Hoosier Action.
Unlike Joe, my experience has not been positive at all with unemployment. It's been nonstop struggle basically since March. I'm still employed, scheduled to go back to work later this month, but when schools closed, I had to stay home with my kids for the remainder of the school year. And then during summer break, I had the childcare provider that I planned on using for summer break to work say they did not want to watch children this year. They didn't want to have kids in and out. So I found another childcare provider who also decided that they did not want to watch children. So that's just been a battle trying to find. I haven't been able to find childcare for my kids. So aside from all that, I applied for unemployment. I received a few weeks worth of benefits, and then that stopped, and I haven't received anything since the first week of June. And I believe that's the experience of many people right now. They've applied and they're approved. They're not pending approval. They're just waiting to get a paycheck or an unemployment check, I should say, for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and nothing's getting paid. So the efficiency of the unemployment office right now is, I don't know what word to use for it, but it's been really, really hard. I think for a lot of people, that a lot of people think, well, they're getting all this money from unemployment, but really so many of us aren't getting all this money from unemployment. We're getting nothing.
The moratorium on Indiana evictions and foreclosures will expire this Friday on August 14th. We will have more reporting on that in the coming days.
The Monroe County Election Board discussed using Edgewood High School as an election site during their August 6th meeting. Board President Hal Turner said he sent a letter to the school president.
And I asked him the following question: will the gym where we normally vote be reserved for or used for any COVID-related auxiliary social distancing classroom space or any other COVID-related purpose on Election Day this year that would prevent its use as an election poll location. His response to me was, yes, Edgewood High School's auxiliary gym will be used as an additional space due to the COVID-19 virus. We're currently in need of additional spaces, especially large spaces, to have proper physical distancing of large classes, such as physical education classes, band classes, and choir classes. Additionally, we are currently still determining if our students will have lunch in the classrooms or in the cafeteria and auxiliary gym. Students are going to be more restricted throughout the day, so we are doing everything we can to give them an opportunity to have the ability to have a period of the day that students can socialize with their friends outside of the scheduled classes. I appreciate the election board's consideration of the safety and mental health needs of the Edgewood High School students.
Board member Nicole Brown said the more polling site options there are, the less crowded the sites will be on election day. She said if the students are not in school in November, the high school should still be used as a voting site. Turner said all polling sites must be reported 60 days before Election Day. Board members decided to continue the discussion until their next meeting. Also during the meeting, Council for Community Accessibility member Chris Jackson spoke about surveying election sites for accessibility.
And this isn't something that we've been involved with for previous elections, so we definitely had some homework to do, but making sure that voting is accessible to all is, of course, a super high priority. It's what makes a democracy function, so we're doing what we can to apply our survey tools to the list of sites. 34 sites now, the list of sites is constantly changing, but we have actually started to go out to those sites. I believe as of today, we've done 11 of those sites with preliminary surveys. Part of our work then involves follow-up discussion on the surveys from the committee members, because sometimes there's some gray areas that we want to discuss first. So we haven't had any of those discussions, but when we're done with all the sites and we're feeling we can get done by the end of August, we will submit a report to the election board that identifies the barriers we've discovered at each site.
Jackson said reports would also be submitted by photograph. Community member Randy Paul said the CCA is not performing an acceptable survey.
It doesn't matter how many, innovative ways you try to get around this. In the end, you're going to have to comply with the ADA. When I've talked with members of CCA, they don't know the difference between the ADA and the Help America Vote Act. Do they differ? Do they conflict? If they do conflict, what do you do about it? There's a rule called the Safe Harbor Law. What is it? When does it apply? When do you have to have it on current buildings or older buildings? The lack of training in this area is astounding. And until you recognize the fact that you have to have trained people out there doing the full surveys, and you're hurting yourselves also, because a large part of this is how to make something usable on Election Day. We showed you. Tree and I showed you in the primary you could do that without costing any money, and now you're going right back to where you were, where you're not complying with the ADA nor the Help America Vote Act. I don't get it. You know, my role has changed. I'm not here now to make suggestions to you or to help you, because now I'm filing the complaint with the Department of Justice. It's going to take a few weeks. It's going to go back 15 years worth of this, including the conversation today. You know, my role now is more of a watchdog than it is somebody who's trying to help you. For 15 years, I tried to help you comply voluntarily, and you wouldn't do it. So now we have to look at forced compliance. My role is much more of a watchdog. I'm going to send my own team out that's trained, and I'm going to review the work of recommendations that you have done. And if you're putting sites out there that aren't HAVA compliant, then I'll go public with it. I'll go on social media, not to call you guys wrong, but to try to help people who've got disabilities have accessibility.
Jackson said the CCA uses an informed survey based from the Department of Justice published guidelines for accessible polling sites in 2016. He said they also look at other documents for survey material.
So we are informed by the Help America Vote Act documents, several documents that the Monroe County Election Board has used in the past, the Department of Justice 2016 guidelines on accessible polling places, and beyond that, the 2010 full ADA guidelines, which we often refer to when we have an area where we feel we need further clarification.
Jackson said they do not have legal authority to enforce any location to accessibility standards. They are just creating a report.
Now it's time for A Few Minutes with the Mayor, where Sydney Foreman poses questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton on community issues. We turn to WFHB Assistant News Director Sydney Foreman for more.
Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. First question today is from user DJ Spikes, and they ask, why are bars open?
Well, bars are open because the combination of state order and local order has let them operate in restricted conditions. It's a question that is fair to ask. Bloomington and Monroe County Health Department has decided to allow them to stay open under conditions of seated service only and no bar service, no standing and no dancing and masks required when you're not at your seat, etc. But we could change that if the indicators are that we see a rise in the spread. So we're just going to have to keep watching, and they might be closed again.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of just touched on this, but what regulations will bars be held to during the fall semester with IU students on campus?
Right now, bars are subject to no bar service. The only service they can do is to people seated at tables, and the tables must be separated by at least 6 feet. So it means no dancing, no stand-up gathering, no congregating except sitting at tables. Also, patrons are required to wear masks anytime they're moving about. If they're not seated at their table, they are allowed to remove the mask while they're seated at their table. They're not allowed to have groups of more than 10 at one table. And all this is, of course, meant to try to stop super spreader events where you get large numbers of people infected by one infected person. You know, this, it could change. Those are the current regulations under the county health order. The city could impose different regulations, or the county could change, or the state could change, depending upon what we see.
Has the city received many complaints of groups or businesses not in compliance with the orders through the city hotline?
We got a couple dozen calls over a 9-day period. So I wouldn't say that's a lot. Some of them were not really serious or profane, which happens sometimes. But there were a few calls indicating an establishment or a proprietor that didn't require masks and stuff. And we followed up with all of those. I think the county, which has now been operating their call line for a week plus, has had a little higher incidence, maybe I think 30 or so. And those are helpful, and we appreciate them. And there's follow-up with each one. But it's not a large number, but it's not zero either.
And how are these complaints being handled? Like you said, who is responding to these complaints?
Well, it varies. When the city was doing this directly, we would typically call a proprietor, though I know there was a visit or two made as well by different city employees. Some are out of Community and Family Resource Department. We actually send firefighters sometimes on their shifts to stop in on places. Our engagement director made some calls. So it's a range of people. I think from the county, most of the responses are from the county health department. So sometimes it's police if it's a private party or something like that. So it's a whole range of different people who can respond depending upon what the situation is.
So the next question I have is, does the city have any plans to help families who will face eviction once the eviction moratorium ends to finding housing?
Evictions are a really big threat to individual households, families, as well as to our community. Some of the data looking at what might happen is staggering. 200,000 families in Indiana, I saw, or maybe more, that could be subject to that. So it's a really important issue because an eviction is so traumatic and can create such turmoil for families. So we're very interested in trying to do what we can. I believe most of the help on this should come from the federal government and the state government. The moratoriums and the financial assistance is at a scale that it just really is going to take federal resources probably to do this. So we're certainly encouraging, and I would encourage everybody to reach out to our federal congressmen and senators to pass another round and to continue the moratorium. The second thing is the county is in a very central position with the township trustees to help if there are evictions eventually or if there are issues like that. The county-wide has dedicated $100,000 and has indicated their willingness to consider more through the township trustees if there's a need for eviction protection. And that covers everybody in the county, including all city residents, through the township trustees. And that's kind of a government safety net that has traditionally been there for people who really need rental assistance. So the city is standing ready to help with that if need be, if we hear from it. But the basic infrastructure for that locally is the county and the township trustees. And they've already taken some steps to do that. But again, it's really the federal government.
The last question I have for you today is, last week, City Council approved an ordinance appropriating funds from the General Fund, the Parks General Fund, and the Jack Hopkins Funds to support your Recovery Forward plan. Could you speak about what these funds will be used for?
It's a whole range of things, and I'm pleased that the council has a final vote on it this week. We hope Wednesday the 12th. They took a preliminary vote last week, but Wednesday the 12th, they should vote. We hope to support that as a final matter. So this Recovery Forward Stage 1 is focused on trying to help our community climb out of the economic calamity that we're in. And it's been focused on really three areas. They include jobs assistance to try to help make sure people can get back into jobs with some training support and some matching money support, and about $500,000 of that. It includes affordable housing support, in particular, trying to help families who face an opportunity to get home ownership, but maybe can't quite get it done because of the economic situation or others, to help them do that. And then that's about $500,000. And then over $1 million is focused on really sustainability and quality of life. They include things like helping build more efficiency in homes and apartments and small businesses to help them lower energy costs. It includes things like improving our bus stops so that they're more accessible and to people, to all, and improving some paths and sidewalks, as well as some agriculture support, local agriculture, local arts, a little digital equity to help make sure with everybody needing access to the internet for schools and other things that we do that. So I will say among those three categories, they're really all meant to help us recover in the right way, to move forward toward climate justice, toward racial justice, and toward economic justice. And each of these little pieces adds up to a way to move our community in the right way.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at wfhb.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,